Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
All this week, we're taking time to reflect on 2017. We've talked about the top stories in sports, music, and science, and later this hour, we'll dig into pop culture and civil rights. But we want to start today by looking at what happened this year in technology. From fake news to Bitcoin to Boston's Amazon bid, there's been a lot of ground to cover. There is a lot of ground to cover. And joining me in studio to talk about it all is Sarah Watson. She's a tech critic and affiliate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Welcome to Radio Boston, Sarah.
Hi, Shira.
Hi. So what developments in the tech world stood out to you in 2017? And if there was sort of a theme for this year in tech, I know my theme is the year of fear. But for you, what stood out and what theme stood out to you?
Yeah, fear is definitely in the water. I think there's something also about the idea that this year is the year we started talking about technology companies as big tech, like capital B, capital T, in the same way that we talk about big industries like big oil. And I think that's partly because these companies have started to grow up, they've started to mature, but they're also so inextricably part of our everyday lives. And, you know, they are our access to news, they are our access to every consumer good possible. And so it's clear now that we are reliant on these companies, and that comes with a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. One of the big companies in the news right now is Facebook. They have over 2 billion monthly active users. And for those who are curious, they define active users as people who have logged into Facebook during the last 30 days. And they have been heavily involved or embroiled in the whole fake news controversy. There were Russian bots, and then I guess more than 3,000 ads posted on Facebook during last year's election were tied to Russian accounts, and that, you know, fell into this year. The repercussions of that fell into this year. How did that happen? Like, how does that happen? Is Facebook not aware of what's going on, of their vulnerabilities? And you know, how do we get to this point where people are using tech to sort of infiltrate our lives in this way?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different ways it happened. I think one of which is an easy answer, which is no human being was looking at the ads or the postings that anyone was posting, right? Like, it's such an automated programmatic system that it was happening automatically and in the background, and there was also no oversight or check after the fact, right? So it would have to be, you know, enough people noticing or flagging something to say, you know, this is weird or this is questionable behavior. Since then, Facebook has started to talk about ways that they could automate some of recognizing some of that weird behavior. And companies like Twitter also look at that kind of behavior for, like, new accounts of people who might be trying to target, you know,
specific audiences.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you optimistic, though, about the measures that Facebook and Twitter are taking to remedy this?
So they're starting pretty slow, and they're starting on the small scale. For example, Facebook is now saying that they're going to do something about political advertising. And for a long time, they've completely avoided any kind of ad disclosure regulation that almost every other media company has had to follow. So they've kind of been able to put that off for a long time, and now they're finally going to address that. But that's such a small piece of the bigger problem. So I'm hopeful that, you know, they're addressing some of the concerns. They are being held more accountable because we're all kind of more aware of the worst case scenario. Like, the worst case scenario kind of has happened. These platforms that we've created have been exploited in ways that we are not comfortable with. So it's important that we're all talking about it. But we need to keep having that conversation about what we're comfortable with. And it's hard to do until you know all of the things that are capable of happening on Facebook or any other platform for that matter.
So I think you're sort of answering what my next question was what can we do? What, as you know, we as the consumers, the people who are using Facebook, the 2 billion users and the people who are using Twitter, is it just awareness? Is it just being informed of, you know, what it looks like when these tech companies are trying to influence you?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me is paying attention to what you're doing, being conscious of what you're consuming and where you're getting your information from. But my other big thing is to look at the defaults. So Facebook is trying to get you to spend more time on Facebook. Really, that's their business model. And, you know, whether that means showing you more of what you like or more of something that's incendiary and, you know, getting a lot of commentary and traction because it's, you know, something that's, you know, contested. Mm-hmm. It's Facebook doing what it needs to do to get you to stay.
Yeah, they have all those algorithms that kind of feed the beast in some ways, right?
And so for now, we haven't really had any insight into how those work, except that we assume that they're trying to get you to spend more time there. I think what's possible now is that, you know, you can tweak individual things on your Facebook feed. You can look at any given post and say, show me less of this or more of this, like stop following this person, don't show me this publication anymore. Those are all really micro-targeted interactions that you as the user can adjust. But I think going forward, Facebook is going to have to give some of that more control over to the users on a more systematic basis.
Now, you mentioned the worst case scenario with all of this has already happened, obviously referring to the 2016 election. And earlier this year, we spoke to Jonathan Taplin. He's the author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Here's what he had to say.
They're not just enormous in terms of their own business sectors. They're the largest companies in the world. You know, 10 years ago, ExxonMobil, Citibank, General Electric were the largest companies in the world. Today, it's Apple, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Microsoft. And so they totally not only dominate the tech world, they dominate politics. And these people really don't seem to care.
So do you agree that these companies are, in effect, undermining democracy?
I don't know if I would go that far because I think they have good intentions and continue to want to support, you know, good behavior and good democratic process, right? At least in the places.
At least we hope,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. I think you're starting to see a lot of people in these companies start to actually recognize the backlash and actually kind of state their remorse for what they've built. You know, Facebook's VP of user growth said he was afraid that Facebook was ripping apart the social fabric of society. Sean Parker has said that he's a conscientious objector of social media. And, you know, he's said things about the fact that this technology is exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. These are their quotes, right? Like, mm-hmm. They're starting
aware.
To be aware. And mm-hmm. even you know, Mark Zuckerberg himself for Yom Kippur said, you know, he was atoning for, you know, the ways that his technology was used to divide people rather than to bring us together. So there's a reckoning.
So it's interesting. I wonder if the folks from Equifax are atoning too, because we mentioned the year of fear and, you know, the Equifax breach is something that really stands out to me. Hackers were able to gain access to Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers for as many as 145 million Americans. Why was this breach so significant? Because it's really bigger than just a privacy breach, right?
Absolutely. It's in part, it's the scale, right? This is pretty unprecedented. But I think the bigger thing is that it's kind of unavoidable to be a part of this data set. If you are participating in the credit economy as an American or anyone else beyond that, you know, you might be part of this data set. And it's not something that we've really had to opt into. And in part, it's also, you know, it's not always Social Security numbers and license numbers that are part of breaches. And so that's really the most identifying information that we have exposure to.
Do you think we're going to see people actively moving away from technology? Is this going to become a trend in the future, sort of a tech minimalism?
I think people start to be more conscious of the choices that they're making and the ways that they're exposing themselves to technology and the ways that their data is out there. I'm hopeful that there's at least a little bit more awareness as a result of the events of this year.
So we've talked about how tech is sort of invading every part of our lives or influencing it and sort of is right in our face. It may actually get really right in our face if Amazon comes to the Boston area.
I hope not.
I was going to ask you how you felt about it, but I think you're pretty clear there. Amazon announced that they received 238 proposals for its second headquarters in North America. 26 of those came from Massachusetts, including one from Boston. Now, you don't want to see it. You don't want to see Amazon here. But how did you feel about the whole process?
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible to me how much cities were willing to, like, prostrate themselves in front of the potential of growth of this huge company that is so clearly becoming more and more a part of our everyday lives. I think the big thing for me is looking at, you know, what the real estate market looks like in Seattle. You know, do we really want to?
I was going to say housing prices are way up. Yes,
and Seattle used to be an affordable place to live, and that's not the case anymore. So I worry about that kind of larger impact on a geographic area.
Talking about another place that's sort of become, has become unaffordable to live. You've got Silicon Valley. And I want to turn to Silicon Valley and what happened there, because it became part of the Me Too movement.
I might argue that it was kind of pushing the Me Too argument first.
Well, at least before
the Weinstein moment.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the Susan Fowler moment.
Right.
And if for those who don't recall, she was the engineer at Uber who revealed the company's culture of sexism and harassment in a February blog post that went viral. This happened after she left Uber. And like you said, she really did start that tidal wave of women coming forward and speaking out against the tech industry and harassment by venture capitalists. And it really rocked Silicon Valley and led to an internal investigation at Uber and the firing of 20 people there. And also in the wake of this, CEO and founder Travis Kalanick resigned. So is this sort of a sustainable change, or is this a moment where it's going to kind of revert back to what's been there?
Oh, I hope it's sustainable. But I think it's been building for a very long time. You know, even Ellen Pao, who was had her Kleiner Perkins trial a couple years ago, now has a book out about all of her experiences in the kind of venture capital side
of
things.
Yeah, and Susan's coming out. Susan Fowler's coming out with a book as well, and I think a movie about her experiences at Uber.
Right. So there's some momentum, and I think it's part of this larger 2017 moment. I mean, you know, women have been writing about their negative experiences in the technology field for many years, and just do a search on Medium and you'll find hundreds and hundreds of accounts of bad behavior and bad experiences. So I think this is part of this larger tipping point where people are actually being held accountable. People are being listened to. And that's where, you know, what happened at Uber is at least a compelling instance of, you know, people spoke out and something happened as a result of it.
And it's not just women. There was a report from the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council that came out last month. It estimates it will take until 2085 before African Americans are represented at the same level as white men are in technology industry today in Massachusetts, until 2045 for Latinos, and until 2070 for women. So there seems to be a lot of evidence this year, though, that people don't want to wait. How can tech companies, universities, and others sort of shorten or condense that timeline?
Yeah, everyone always makes the argument that it's about the kind of engineering pipeline and the education that, you know, supports that. I think that's going to change really quickly. You just look at college enrollment stats about computer science right now is, you know, shooting up through the roof, even specifically here at Harvard. But I think the bigger thing is that it really matters to have diversity in these workplaces, because these are the people who are responsible for building the platforms that are shaping our lives. And it really matters that we are getting the input from a bunch of different people who have very different experiences.
Now I want to switch gears to Bitcoin. This is the digital currency that made big news just last week when it hit $19,500 for the valuation for one Bitcoin. That's up from around $900 last year. Wish I had invested. What made the Bitcoin such a hot commodity this year? And also, I mean, it's part of that, it seems to me, sort of a distrust of traditional financial institutions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that to me is the reason why now, because there's not really any other reason for this kind of speculative bubble to happen, aside from the fact that, you know, Bitcoin was designed to, you know, be a distributed, encrypted, anonymous ledger system that would allow banking to happen without banks. It's since kind of not really realized that potential because, you know, there's all this infrastructure that has built up around it. So it looks a lot like the way that you know, traditional finance has always kind of chugged along with a lot of oversight and a lot of hassle. I mean, even in some of the speculative moments, Coinbase had shut down trading. So how is that kind of getting outside of this traditional banking system? I think what this is an indication of is more of this 2017 moment of not really trusting institutions, trying to get around that, but with limited success, I think.
I was going to say, hopefully that will change as we turn to 2018. That's Sarah Watson. She is a tech critic and affiliate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks, Shira.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.